Okay, so I guess this is supposed to be a discussion session.
Oh, you want this up here?
Yes.
You want it up here so that people actually hear me. Okay.
So this is supposed to be a discussion session about what we've been thinking about in the last few weeks about the memory program. And I guess we could start anywhere, but I thought maybe the place to start for me, and anyone can interrupt if they think differently, is that we've been hearing a lot of talks that I would kind of classify as all about return point memory in one form or another. And so what do I mean by that? Well, we heard Mahiton's talk about pinning and how that had a nested loop of things inside the great big loop that you could form. Then we heard Karen's talk about that, and then we heard things about pinning versus yield, and all of these things had certain things in common, which was that you push something and it pushes up to a certain point, and then when you let go, you can then start pushing again, and somehow it remembers that last place at which it had been pushed. I mean, that was one part of the hallmark of this return point memory. But then in thinking about that, there seemed to be a bunch of other things that we've learned about in this, which is not necessarily all the same. And so there may be classes of return point memory inside that. So one of the things that I saw was there was a, when you have the return point memory a la the Randenfield-Ising model, Randenfield-Feral magnets, was that you have a hysteresis curve that you could then go up, so let's see if I can draw it and not screw it up. So you have a curve that looks like this, and so this would be M and this would be H, something like this. And so this would be, if you've trained it this way, it remembers this and it'll go back and forward along this loop over and over and over again. That is, it doesn't particularly, it doesn't find new states within this loop. But if you came up to this point and then went backwards, you didn't go all the way up to, so this goes in this direction, right? But then you come up to here, and then at that point you go backwards. Well, I'm not good at making hysteresis loops, but it would look something like this. And so you now remember this state, but you could have continued going on up to this state, and so you've memorized two memories. You could have stopped in here on the way up and memorized a third. And by memorizing, it's a question of, as you go up, can you see what you've done before? And you can see because you have a kink at each of these points where your magnetization versus H curve has a discontinuity. Now, so this is something that happened in some of the models. I think it happened in your model. It happened in the what Karen told us about. But if you have trained it like this, but then you go up to this point, then you lose all of these memories. Those memories get washed out, and they never are, I mean, you can't see them anymore. So the question, one question that I have is, well, do all of these things that we've been talking about where you push up to a certain point and then come back, can you remember things in that, in this region? That is, it's not clear to me that all the things having to do with yield and not, what was the other, it's not yield, but the other word.
Plasticity.
Thank you. I mean, you do remember this last state. I don't know, once you've done that, can you remember a state inside here? So this would then be a different, I mean, it's a somewhat different memory. That, I mean, there's a distinction to be made here, I mean, as to whether you can remember a whole lot of things or you only can remember one. And so this is one distinction. And then the other distinction is with sheared non-Brownian suspensions, where you can remember things, both many things, both going up and going down. And so that you don't erase things completely just by one fell swoop. And that was also in the charge density wave picture. So this is one thing, and I don't know whether people want to, you know, have anything to say about whether these memories, I mean, how many things you can get, let's say, in plasticity or...
Yeah, so maybe you're thinking about the sheared Brownian suspensions, so it's...
Non-Brownian suspension.
Non-Brownian, sorry, of course, yeah, sheared non-Brownian, otherwise. So the thing is that you get the multiple memories, as I understood from the last discussion, in two ways. You know, one of which I knew was that, you know, there is noise in the system, you know, and so the noise allows it to retain multiple memories. The other was that, but, and so it would be sort of like, that. The other one was that you would able to retain multiple memories because each of these kinks or the memories had sort of extremely long relaxation times. So as long as your transients were comparable with this relaxation times, they would have not kind of all relaxed away so that only the largest amplitude remained. And that was the other mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. So these were both, in some sense, transient mechanisms. I mean, whereas, you know, for example, this loop here is kind of like a, you know, the transients had disappeared. So the fact that you were retaining multiple memories was an effect of the transients, which in this picture would be an effect of how you got, you know, it was an effect of the way that led to this loop, where you did not really get to this loop either because you were constantly being perturbed by noise, or you just hadn't, you know, you hadn't cycled it long enough.
Well the thing, I mean, I don't know whether we want to get into the very details of it, but with the non-Brownian suspensions, what was, and I think it was also there in the charge density wave thing, so Sue, so you probably remember better than I do about that, but there was a distinction between how the memory was formed and something about how it was erased. And the way I see it in the case of the non-Brownian suspensions was that the erasure is somehow an evaporation from the edge. And as I recall, that was kind of the type of thing that you looked at in the charge density wave system, that is, you had a system and then it was all memorized in there at one level, but then the things at the end went and they spread out slowly, and that was kind of an evaporation from the edge of this thing, leaving the interior kind of fixed.
Yeah.
Am I remembering it all?
Remembering it right. On the other hand, I think, I mean, in one way, it's sort of like that thing at the edge was sort of keeping it from reaching equilibrium, though. So I'm sort of agreeing with both of you at the same time. That given that you were perturbing it at the edge, it was sort of as close to equilibrium as it could possibly be. But on the other hand, it was getting perturbed at the edge.
Yeah, but the way it got erased, there's a reason that when you put on the wrong, the memory that was going to be erased, it does leave, but it takes a long time for that to disappear.
Yes.
And that's the point I'm trying to make, is that's the evaporation part, is that it evaporates from the edge so that the internal stuff, which was that memory, which is eventually going to get erased,
oh, I see what you're trying to say.
Is stuck there for a while until that other process goes through, and that's a longer-term process.
But I still think Mahitan said something which I think I agree with, which is that the point was that there were sort of fast things that happened, and the memory was encoded in a pretty fast way, but then there was this very slow relaxation process that, in order to forget, there was another time scale of forgetting.
Okay. Does anyone know what we're talking about? I just realized that maybe we're talking code and only... shaking your head means you don't know?
Or,
okay. So maybe we should just go back for a second and just go over the easiest ingredients of that non-branch suspension model, just so that you can do it. And so the idea here is, so if you look at this in a one-dimensional line. So this is Johnson. Simplifying it. Pardon?
Non-branch suspensions.
Non-branch suspensions.
Yeah, which I think is probably easier.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just find it easier to think about because it's pushing rather than...
Right. Yeah, because then you have to get into this long story.
But I think my impression was that the physics is really the same in both cases. That's why.
And this is a nicer.
And this is an easier way to explain it, I think.
Yeah, easier to visualize for sure.
Yeah. And so the idea with this is that you have your line and you put points down at random. So they can be close or far. But they're done at random. And so this is your system. So you have n particles on this line. And then what you do is you... So you place particles. And then you swell all particles. So each one of these things now, you can think of as just becomes a sphere. They just come up. And so if they swell this much, these two particles don't see each other and they don't interact. They never see each other. But these two clearly do, when they get swelled that much, they run into each other. And so then you keep track of those that ran into each other versus those that did not run into each other. And then you unswell them, you put them down as back to points. And you kick those that ever overlapped. Pardon?
Kicking which side?
It actually doesn't matter. And so the simplest thing is that you can actually analyze somewhat to death is you keep the center of mass always fixed. That is, if something gets kicked, these two particles interact. They both get equal and opposite kicks. Mm-hmm. So they can either go this way or they can go that way. Or you can make it completely... repulsive, so that it goes as quickly to the end state as possible. Or you could let these things kick randomly different amounts. I mean, you can do all of those things. In all of the cases, you get basically for the memory part, it doesn't make any particular difference. Okay.
Maybe for Kirk, so the kick here just means a random displacement.
Yes. And so kick means these two didn't overlap. So they don't get touched at all. They, when you've unswelled them, they go back to their original position. These two overlapped, and so they get kicked by some small amount, let's say equal and opposite, and they could have gone repulsive, for example. That's the simplest things, but that doesn't matter for the the memory part of this, I don't think.
How is this different than just saying find the two particles that are closest and they experience a kick?
No, because I am I swell them all to a certain amount to size.
That's the shear.
Oh, so you only unswell the ones that you are kicking.
So what am I doing? So each of these things are particles on the line. They all swell out to the size R, and there will be some here which also overlap, some that don't overlap. These two overlapped. And now I've said, I have in this small system, I had three things that overlapped. Now I go back to the initial condition again, but each one of these I kicked by some small amount. And now I go back to the original. And so now they're new positions. This one is now just a little bit farther apart. This is a little farther apart. These are a little closer together. And the other ones haven't moved.
So this swelling is like all of a sudden to R. It's not that you're incrementally...
That's right. I'm doing everything out to R. Not. So, yes, it's a quick algorithm. I don't have to swell it, you know, and do it. I can just look how many are this close. But the physical thing is that I'm swelling and contracting again.
Can they pass each other when you move them again?
No, I mean, that is, in the rules that we've looked at, they can't, but if you certainly have repulsive things, then they never would pass through each other. So, again, I don't think these things matter very much for, I mean, these are specific rules. Pardon? Yeah. So this is one pass through, okay?
So that means that depending on R, you can have an absorbing state.
That's right. So if R were tiny, 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 nothing would ever interact with anything else, and that state wouldn't have evolved at all.
And then if it's an intermediate, you can have some kicks, and at some point you stop in an absorbing state.
So that's what I'm going to get to now, is what this absorbing state is.
And you do the updates in parallel.
Yeah.
And have you tried it in... sequentially, does
like
it make a difference?
Like the protocol, right? Like, you know, the moment they kick, you do the kick, and then...
Yeah, but I mean, for example, I don't know, there are two of these particles which are closest together. So mm-hmm. imagine that you do the kick on that one, yeah. and that pair,
yeah.
and then you look for the next one, and so on.
I can conceive that that could make a difference in some cases. Mm-hmm. I don't think it makes a difference if we've kept the center of mass fixed, because if the center of mass is fixed and the kicks are tiny,
yeah.
then once I've given you the initial state, the final state is fixed, and you know where you're going to end up for any R, just because that's anything in that cluster is going to eventually hit itself. So I don't think that makes a difference in at least some of the models. I mean, I can imagine that if you did random kicks, and then that will change things, and if center of mass isn't fixed, these things can float along and do things, and that would be different. But since that doesn't make a difference to the memory so much, I don't think...
And what happens if your rule for the kick would make your swap? So do you have a... You need to have. You're saying they cannot exchange, right? Positions.
Yeah.
So you have a kick, and if it would happen, so.
But the kick is tiny.
So
and so certainly if I the thing is that if this is infinitesimal kicks, and we say they're coming like this, and now they pass through each other, I don't care, because it would have just been like these two things have moved in the opposite direction. That part, I don't think, again, matters, but for simplicity, let's not let them over, go through each other, and they only see their nearest neighbors, and they don't see second nearest neighbors. I mean, that is... And those... these get kicked this way, and now you have a new state, and you go back and you start this over again with that new state, and they now, those that overlap this time, get kicked, you go back, those overlap that time, get kicked, and so forth, until, if it's possible, those that, if the swelling is not too large, then eventually all these particles will be in a way where they've swelled enough so that they no longer, they don't swell too much so that once they've been swelled, they don't overlap anymore. And so at that point, there's only one degree of freedom in here you care about, which is the distance between the points. Right? That's the only thing, which is kind of what you were asking. Could you use that? But that's not the way the physics goes in here. But that is, at the end, what you have. And so the question is, what do you memorize in this? And so if you get to the end of this, I'm trying to make this look like they're equally spaced, if that's the idea. And so each one of these is some shear gamma 1. That's the spacing between these things at that swelling. And what this is saying is, well, these things had been closer together. After all these kicks, they've just moved apart so that they just touch. And now you see all this pileup of distances that are exactly gamma 1, and that's the memory. As you can see, you can read out that this was what you pushed it to, because anything smaller leaves gaps at the side. Nothing happens until you reach gamma 1. If you go gamma 1 plus epsilon, now these things start to interact again, and you continue until the gamma 1 plus epsilon is the one that's memorized. Is that...
And it's kind of at the edge, because, you know, this gammas will just increase barely, so that it's just sufficient not to, you know, so this is what Sue was saying, that it was, that it's kind of at the edge of this sort of stability.
Yeah, but easier to visualize what happens.
But somehow I imagine there's going to be a cluster with this spacing gamma 1 and then some empty space.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Because the average spacing is not changing.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And so depending on how big I've made gamma 1, I can spread this thing out so that they're equally spread through the whole distance L. I mean, if I just exactly match that. But typically, if gamma 1 is sufficiently small, there'll be little clusters of this. Spacing, a little cluster, different size here. Spacing, another cluster, maybe larger here, and it will. And so this is now just part of a much, much longer line that I'm trying to draw.
So, Sid, in this perspective, you have a process where you basically eliminate the lowest intervals in your system.
Mm-hmm.
And you directly affect only the direct neighbors when kicking. Isn't it extremely close to the backsnipping model we were discussing last time, where you get a distribution of ratios mm-hmm. between 0 and 1? You pick up the lowest one, and you change the two neighbors.
So I don't know enough about that model. Do you remember, Sue? I mean, this is probably your...
That one had avalanches, and this one yeah. goes to an absorbing state. So, I think it's because
you
keep going.
I mean, obviously, backsnapping, if you're below the critical state, you go to some kind of absorbing state.
Right, and then... which isn't surprising, because that was the origin of backsnapping. I mean, you know, again, historically, it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
But the backsnapping would be kind of what Leticia had said. You know, as you raise your parameter R,
yeah.
the moment two balls basically touch, you immediately kick them.
Yeah.
Right. So and since you kick them, now they can be touching with someone else. So right. you keep on kicking them while you keep R constant until you have sort of resolved that kick event. And then you keep on increasing R again. So this is now kind of like an extremal process where you go after the first kick, the guys that are closest, you kick them, do whatever you do until that guy at his vicinity is happy, then you keep on increasing R again. And in a way, it is similar like Bach's statement, because what Bach's statement says is it kind of it takes a certain mass from that guy and distributes it amongst its neighbors, right? Forget that. Sorry, so undo.
Okay. I'm just the fitness, right?
Yes, just fitness. Yeah. You just select the
lowest
decimal value.
Yeah.
You replace it by your new value, and you replace also the two neighbors.
Yeah, this is what I was saying. There's an update also on the. Yeah, this kind of would make
but
sense.
But here you also affect the two neighbors because you by the kicking you change the interval between.
I mean that's. So that would certainly be there, and so what you will get in here are, how would I try to draw this? The way that we would look at this is, if this is a fraction that are moving at any instant of time, as in any one cycle, versus gamma, at the beginning, the fraction is going to be a monotonically increasing function. It has to, that is, because if they interact at small gamma, they will also those ones will also have interacted at a larger one. So those will always be kicked. So this thing has to always be a positive monotonically increasing function. And this is, let's say, the initial state where these things are can be very close and move out. And then as you train this thing over and over again, what you're going to get is the ones that are here. Let's say I'm going to train it at gamma 1 here. So I train this at gamma 1. Then the ones that are out here are not particularly being touched, but the ones in here are. And so what you're going to get is that shape. And it's not obvious why it's this shape, but it is this shape. So the point is that there's a cusp here, and this is the memory. At the end of the day, this is what this thing looks like. And so it's complete memory out to here. That is, you cannot do anything in here. You just can't see. There are no particles closer than gamma 1 out to here, but it's in this transient region. All the way until you reach this point, you can still see this memory. So then the issue...
Because this is with open boundaries?
No, that is, I can have open boundaries
but
or
if you had an R too large, then you need to keep in there some distance.
So this is for small enough gamma. So if gamma gets too large, then you're above what's called the absorbing state transition, and then... Actually, then memories stay forever in that case, but that's a different a question that maybe we can get to in a bit. But
one is tempted to say yield transition for this model,
but
one is tempted to call this a yield transition for this model.
Yes.
Because these things just come. And that is the kind of thing that looks more closer to Bach-Snepen, because Bach-Snepen never stops. You know, here you basically stop when you say, look, everyone is now a distance gamma, at least away from each other. I have nothing to update. Whereas Bach-Snepen will say, well, I will still go after the smallest distance and keep on doing this. So the Bach-Snepen is kind of this, you know, in the case of Bach-Snepen, you don't get an absorbing state. You get sort of, you know, what you limit to is just
okay.
Sort of a...
Good. So if that's what the model is, then this is quite different from that, because this is the one that contains this idea of what the memory is of what you've done to it.
Yeah, right. Bach-Snepen model goes that self-organized critical, right? So you always reach a critical state.
Yeah.
And then that's...
Which is a stochastic steady state.
Which is,
you know.
Which is related to the fact that it's always looking at the weakest sort of species and eliminating them. It doesn't stop anywhere.
Once it has sort of, you know, so it never says, you know, my creation is good now and let there be life, or so it's just constantly tinkering with the...
Is there anything that the gamma changes with? You know, like, is anything there that this quantity gamma that you are getting to, does it change? Like, is there any parameter in the model that you can change so that the value of gamma will change?
No, so gamma is what I'm applying from the outside. That's my external forcing. So that would be like I apply a certain force, and as an experimentalist, I apply a certain force, I get to that point. Or in the these were done in an experiment. So what we did in the experiment was we turned this thing to a certain strain, and so you got to a certain strain over and again, and that's what we applied. And then we ask, could we read that back out again? So this is the externally applied.
But you know, if I apply a transformation, and the transformation is a fixed point, so would I call that fixed point? Fixed point is something I transform the system, it doesn't transform anymore. Would I call that fixed point a property of the transformation or a memory?
Well, look, this is maybe a definitional question. It is a fixed point. There's no, yes, but then the question is, what can we do about that fixed point? And what I'm pointing out, first of all, here is that even before I got to the fixed point, I had the memory. Right? That is, so that was one thing that didn't need to be obvious that you would get that until.
That is transient, that is changing, right?
Yes, but maybe we can hold off for a second. You'll see what happens to the sixth point in a second. But this is all trying to get to one other point before we get to that. And so then the question was, so what you're saying is completely right, and this is that this is a transient behavior. Right, and so everything is happening in the transient here, but then when the transient is over, there's still that memory left in the system, and we can call it a memory because it smells like a memory. That is, I've done something, and I could have done it to gamma 2 or gamma 3, but you can come in the next day and ask, okay, what did I do the night before, and you can read it back out and say, ah, he did it to gamma 1, and so you've gotten the memory that I stored in this material. So that's why I'm calling it a memory, but it has other properties such as being a fixed point and other things too. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a fixed point, but I'm also saying that that fixed point is a kind of a memory in here.
In a plot like this one, tell me again, what are the axes?
So F is a fraction of particles that are being kicked on each cycle. So this is cycle 1, well, cycle 0. This is cycle, I can't spell cycle, C-Y-C-L-E infinity, that is at the end of all the training, whatever, the final one. And these are, that's an intermediate number of cycles, number of trainings that I swell, I've done it 3 times, and that's what I've gotten here. Before I did any, it was just this simple Montana curve, and at the end of the day, it's this completely flat, nothing moves, until I get to above that transition, and then and that's how you can measure whether what I trained it to.
So if you wanted to make this into something like a stress-strain curve, right, could you say that you're adjusting the natural spacing of the particles, right? So they're connected by springs with a natural spacing that's getting updated.
There's no spring in here in this case. I mean, in the charge density wave, there were certainly springs. I mean, but in here, it's just a completely flat landscape. I mean, there's no interactions except that they hit each other. Okay, so there's no spring there. You asked another.
Well, I'm trying to think of yet another variation on this, right? To use this process to update the natural length of springs, and then you measure the force.
So if you were at Joey Paulson's talk in the second week, I guess, of the thing, well, what he showed was in the experiment, you can actually measure the stress as you're shearing this thing, and you can see where here's where they start, the stress suddenly goes up because they start colliding with one another, and so you can see that. Yes. Are there any other questions about the model?
Yeah.
Okay, so then the question that we have is something akin to this question, is can I store more than one memory in here, right? That was the issue. And so what do we see in the when we apply this thing? So what this means is I apply size R, well, I should call it gamma 1, because that's what I've called it here. And now then we swell all particles, and then the next time we do all particles to gamma 2, and then do gamma 1 again, gamma 2, gamma 1, gamma 2. So I'm swelling, then, you know, back and forth. That's, these two things, big, small, big, small, big, small, big, small, big, small, and can I remember both the big and the small? And so if you look at this kind of a diagram, what that looks like, so this is again gamma, this is the fraction that are being kicked in each cycle. The initial state is exactly the same as this. The final state, if gamma 1 is the bigger of the two, is exactly the same as what I had here. But in between, when I'm doing gamma 1 and gamma 2, so if gamma 2 is here, what you see is you see two kinks coming into this. And so this means that I can actually read out two memories of this. And so that is, so this is somewhat more sophisticated than just what was the largest thing I did to it. Now, it wouldn't be more sophisticated than this if it depended on the order in which I did it. That is, if I did the large amplitude stretch second, last, the last time I did anything to the system, if that meant that I cannot see gamma 2 anymore, then that would be exactly like this return point memory. But the thing is that you can see both gamma 1 and gamma 2, independent of which one you did last. Okay.
The return point memory picture corresponds to me to the picture when the number of cycles is infinite.
No, because when the number of cycles is infinite, I can't learn anything in here. There's, at the number of cycles infinity, this is completely flat. That means that if I try to, so that if that was a larger one, then I try to do a smaller one, I can't begin to store anything down there.
But in a way, I know that I can still remain periodic. So if my
It's periodic, all right. But it's so this is the question. I mean, so one of the things about memory is I want to be able to write it. I want to be able to store those things, but I also want to be able to read it out. And once this thing is totally flat, I can't read it out anymore. So in effect, it's erased. Right? And so that's an erasure thing, which is now different from here than... So look, when I started thinking about this, I thought, oh, well, eraser is means I go back to my initial state. I mean, that's kind of what I thought erasing was. I mean, with a piece of paper, I erased the line and it's back to where I started. That's not what this is doing. It's erasing, for sure, but what it's doing is it's making the final state incapable of any memory in this region. And that's a different kind of erasing. Now, it might be in some other variable. I mean, but in this variable, it's gone. Right? That's the point. And so it would be interesting, are there other variables that you could apply to this to make this?
So the basic difference is, in some sense, this is really a clean slate, except maybe the gamma that you've trained it in. This picture still has a lot of structure. So there's, you know, so yeah. I mean, in a way, this is a loop associated with the gamma, but because it's a loop, it has a whole bunch of substructure that still remains. Whereas here, basically, what remains is just a single absorbing state that is absorbing as long as your gamma stays between, you know, below this gamma training, and that's it.
That's right.
So both are absorbing, but this is absorbing with a hell lot of a structure. This basically is just plain absorbing.
That's right.
Seems to me if the dust is large enough and you don't get into the absorbing state, maybe there could be something interesting then.
Yeah, and so that's what I'm going to be saying, what happens in that case. Ken?
It's just my vague impression. But in the hysteresis case, you have some static landscape behind, which is hierarchical. But in the right model, once you finish the gamma 1 final state, you wiped out the landscape.
Yeah, and so this is something that I guess I want to get to also. I mean, one of the issues that I think were, at least have been puzzling me hearing all these talks, I mean, I maybe everyone else understands, but I don't, is that in some sense, this is a marginal state in Sue's language, which I think is you push this thing, you push it, does whatever it does, until it finally is at a point where now the next thing would have cost it, and so it's some corner in phase space, and it gets stuck at that corner, and then that's the last state. It was a flat landscape up to that point. It could have done anything, but once it found that corner, it's stuck there, and that's what the memory is. And that's different from a landscape picture where we have lots of different landscapes. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I think maybe, that's an issue that I'm very interested in, and I don't know how to think about that, particularly to put them all together. But that is something that...
Does this mean that you're generating, you know, multiple sort of metastable states when you're seeing this?
No, they're all completely stable. That is, every state is completely stable. That is, there's the landscape for this is completely flat.
And also the other thing is that this order is important, like you first swell and then, or you can do it like in any order.
I can do it in any order.
It still shows this to...
That was the point.
By order,
that is,
I mean you first swell three times bigger one, then two times smaller one, then...
That doesn't matter.
Can you measure the distribution of the spacings and see maybe how much information is stored in those distributions?
Sure. So look, that in some sense is exactly what this F is. I mean, this F is one-to-one. I mean, there's nothing in this model except those spacings. And so the fraction moving is, I mean, I've moved it, up to this point, there's nothing moving means that the spacing is bigger than that. And then it tells me this number of things have this spacing, this number of things have this spacing, etc.
So it's like a cumulative.
It's a cumulative. It doesn't tell me where the spacing was. This is too coarse grained for that, but it tells me what the distribution spacings are.
It is more.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just say the one thing. So what, some part of this is trivial, I think, in some ways. Oh, this is trivial. But on the other hand, there's something that's not trivial here is, well, how could it remember this guy? This is not, to me, a non-trivial thing. How does it ever remember that there's more than...
Not in the absorbing state. Just during the dynamics.
Sure, but look, give me a break. Give me a break. I've remembered it for a while. And now let's see what we can do with that. Okay, so you're absolutely right, but let me try. I'm still worried about why I was able to even see this to begin with, even after. I wouldn't have seen it if I'd done this.
Yes.
Right. And so that's...
You will see it also if you do the pinning. I mean, because you start from a configuration which is gamma 2, during your dynamics, you will know that it was gamma 2, but then you forget when you arrive.
You see this, I mean, you should equate this with the cycle at infinity. You know, until you get there, there's a whole lot of stuff happening that is not on this picture.
And this is exactly also, you know, and your sort of your double thing is exactly something that happens on the path to that cycle, which you are not drawing here. In some sense, this cycle modulo, you know, that it has a lot of additional structure, you know, is corresponds to the swelling picture at infinity. And this the approach to cycle has, of course, still, you know, if you were caring to observe it, has a lot of, you know, information about the protocol that you're driving it with.
So if you look after the avalanche, you are in absorbing state. If you look during the avalanche, if you resolve the avalanche knows what is the initial configuration.
Okay, so if you...
it's a different model, but it's in the same...
Well, okay, but let's, I mean, maybe, but maybe I can just finish up a little bit and then see where the differences are. But yeah.
Yeah, no, just a comment. In the image of seeing this F as distribution of intervals, as you were saying, so the dip at gamma 2 is roughly telling you that you have many particles which are at distance R2 in your transient configuration. And the other one is telling you that you have already some, which are the final distance they want to be, which is R1. And at this point, you have the two beams.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But now the thing that as someone was saying a bit, how many of these this is just part of a larger thing, and so then there's another gamma one here. So what I want to ask is, why can I ever remember this? Okay, that's the question, because after all, what we know is that if I go up to a, if I do a gamma 2 and I, oh, I'm sorry. Let me put these. So this is going to be the smaller one in this line. Okay.
I think the question about the spacings, I would like to sort of raise again, because the erasure of the smaller amplitude memories that you're talking about here was under a particular measurement. Right? I mean, this, if you look at active particles, but I guess the question was to ask whether if I looked at something like the distribution of spacings, I would still see the memory of this smaller amplitude training in that distribution.
Yes.
Has that been?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, so that's what, I mean, so if everyone has remembered the logo for our program, the logo for our program was this thing. Remember that? That's on the front page of the thing. And if you look at it, there are different shadings in here. Okay, and this is these are the two shadings that showing that you, this is just the pair distribution function in a, if I have a particle at the center in this 2D system, and I just measure where all the particles are, this is what it is. It's cleared out in this propeller region. Lots of stuff end up in these regions here. And if I have only one memory, then it's completely clear in here and nothing, and it's all outside of that. If I have two memories, then you see a difference in shading between these two pictures. Right. So it is in, it's in the pair distribution function, which is the, it's GVAR. But it's an anisotropic GVAR because we've got a shear on it.
That's in the steady state.
Oh, this is in the transient region if I've got this.
I have one stupid idea, but it depends on the rule of the changing the rule. But if you allow to freeze a short scale after you did simulation up to the final state of the gamma 2. Okay, so suppose I fix every block of some Wiggles which is bigger than gamma 1 by chance, and then after the next game by doing the, with gamma 1 which is bigger than gamma 2, your rule is changed so that the fixed part it must be moved collectively.
Okay, so I don't know if that's what I'm going to be saying now, but what I'm trying to now argue is why you can remember this at all. Okay, because I'm now going to go and give it with a gamma 1 greater than gamma 2. So every one of these guys gets kicked. Every single one of them. So why should anything remain? And you would think, okay, everything is washed out. Just the way it would have been if I had gone above this and I start to kick it. But look at what's happening here. Is if I look at this particle here, it gets kicked from the left and from the right equally. This one is getting kicked from the left and the right equally. All of them on the interior of this thing are being kicked equally from the left and the right. And even if you say, well, they don't have to be exactly the same from the left and the right, the density is conserved in that region. And so that means that this point is basically conserved. And the only thing that gets to move are the ones at the edge, which get to evaporate. And that's a slow process, because you have to evaporate the edge, and then you evaporate the next one out, and then the next one out, and next one out. And so this is why you get to remember, even though it's not stable under this, eventually it'll get washed away and get to this fixed point. Right? But this is why in the transient region, just applying the larger gamma doesn't wash everything out. So that's the thing. And so this is what's non-trivial about this model, which I don't, and why I don't know. I can look at a lot of these different things and just by looking at it say, oh, this is going to be generic behavior. They will all have something like this behavior. But this behavior requires really understanding something about the dynamics and how the memories are stored, which is a much more subtle thing. So having said that, so that's why you can get this. And now the question, you're asking, well, if it's just a fixed point, it's just a fixed point. But the other aspect of this is I can store the, so what this says is I can store all the memories for a while, and then they all get washed away. That is, I lose them all, they all get forgotten at the end. But if I add noise to the system, I can remember all these memories indefinitely. Because what it's saying is I'm never allowing it to get to the fixed point. Now, it doesn't mean that I can remember that memory that I did here infinitely long ago, but I'm still able to memorize things in this region. So I can memorize new things. And so this is what I like about this aspect of this is that at least biologists keep using this word plasticity of memory to say something about what, you know, the plasticity of the memory tells you something about how many memories you can have and the ease of being able to store memory. And this now is a very specific realization of that, saying, okay, opposite what I would have naively expected is that noise makes memories harder to form. This is actually the plasticity is associated with having the noise. That is, if I didn't have the noise, the plasticity would go to zero at the end.
I mean, you can do that if the noise goes beyond a certain limit. Right?
No, there's any noise. This is a good question. I'm giving you my knee-jerk reaction of what I think happens, but I don't know this. When we did this, we searched for the, we wanted to show this, and so we searched for where we got the biggest bang for the buck, right? But I think that if I had infinitesimal noise and I had an infinite system and infinite time to study this, I would still be able to do it, just not as well. And if I kicked it enormous, so I have enormous amount of noise, again, if I have an infinite system, on average, something will still be remaining. So I think there's a peak in where it's really good, but I don't think there's a transition between where the noise matters and where it doesn't, except at zero. Right? But that's my knee-jerk reaction. So it's not as if I know that for a fact, but that's what I suspect. So this is what I was just trying to get to. Why we put this up was this discussion of what's evaporating, and so it's the discussion of evaporation was this kind of effect going on, saying, okay, the time to erase a memory is long, and so once you have that memory, it stays there and doesn't get erased by a single hit. And so if I have only memories of one spacing of gamma, only two particles that far apart, then that's a goner. I mean, that doesn't stay for any time whatsoever. I only get to have that memory staying for a long time if I have a row of these gammas together, so that then they evaporate from the end and it takes a while for it to get to the center.
Can you characterize this long transient as an intermediate asymptote, like a scaling function?
Can I scaling function
so the spreading, does spreading satisfy some self-similarity?
Sort of like avalanches, you're saying, if you think of it like avalanches.
You can do a lot, so that there's one model which we could really, I think, nail and solve. This is what, which is the one-dimensional model, infinitesimal kicks, but equal and opposite, so the center of mass conserved, and always repulsive. So that was one that we could actually, you know, write down the what's happening in that. And so, yes, you get certain, you know, you can look and see what f is as a function of time, and, you know, it has basically almost stretched exponential behavior, and you can kind of solve for why stretched exponential behavior. Now, is that a scaling thing? I don't know if it's a scaling thing, but it's a solution to that model. It's simple enough that you can do it. That was the thing. I mean, so it's a question of, I mean, finding out what your what the size of your different interacting regions are going to be, and so it's a and so that feeds into, I think, what other people have talked about to some extent of, you know, maybe those techniques can be used in other cases as well. But the one other thing I just wanted to say, just give me half a sec, is that everyone has been asking about, well, there's some place above which these things, if gamma 2 times n is larger than the size of the system, then clearly this thing can never be completely happy. Right. And so does that kill everything? And so the answer to that is no. All you need to do, you can set the noise now equal to zero, because those extra kicks that you get are like a noise. And so this thing still remembers this stuff internally without having to apply an external noisy thing. So what's that transition called? Absorbing state transition doesn't stop this thing from working above it.
If you're in the ergodic.
Right, I mean, so you're getting lots of things that are kind of trying to be at that thing, and then there's some other region which is too crowded, and then that crowded region can move over, but it then leaves another region which is trying to be at that region. So you do remember these all of those states, even without applying noise. So it's no longer a transient, because I don't get to any fixed point. The fixed point doesn't exist in that case.
And you can solve this analytically too. If you're above yielding, you can solve it analytically still.
That wasn't what we were looking at, so I don't know what I can and can't do there. I mean, we were just trying to get. We come from the glass community, and what we saw was that these things all look like stretch exponentials. And this is a simple model. Could we solve for why we get a stretch exponential here? And so that was what our effort was. And yes, we can get show that, but that wasn't that was in the lower region where it finally ends at some point.
Stretch exponential for which quantity?
So I'm going to look at f active as a function of t. This is this will go as e to the minus t over some tau to an alpha.
So active is the ones that are being kicked?
The ones are being kicked. And so as time goes on, it'll eventually die away. And it's a good approximation. I mean, it's not exactly a stretch exponential, but it fits very well to stretch exponential, and you can solve it exactly. You have an analytic form for what it looks like, and then you see that it looks. So look, I mean, I didn't mean to get all into this one model, which was what we seem to have gotten stuck on. But I do want to, maybe what I want to be pushing for here is the questions that this raises in my mind for all of this, which is, I mean, we have these various systems which somehow remember a large, the largest thing we've put on it. So where we have this, we have the plasticity, we have the pinning, we have the, this is the random field Ising model. We have all of these things. They all have something that smells the same in these cases. But the question is, are they really all identically the same or not? And some of them have this structure. Some may not. Some may only have this structure without ever being able to do anything internal to this, which I suspect the plasticity things have. I don't see why, but I don't know. But that's a question I'm asking. So that's one set of questions here. And then there's this, which is a different kind of thing, which is, okay, well, this is now has something that smells like this, that is, it remembers that last thing, and it remembers something else in here, but now it remembers both indefinitely, remembers both independent of which one came, was the last one read, or last one applied, I should say, which this one didn't have. If this is the last one applied, you can't read this anymore. Whereas this one doesn't have that, so there's a distinction there. That's one thing. This one has noise in it as a parameter that you want to put in because it helps you understand some things about this. I don't know what, I mean, you particularly told us the energy barriers were so high that that temperature didn't matter in this case, so I don't know what you remember if you did put temperature into this. And so that's another set of things.
I think it would soften up the return point. If you add temperature to this one, the return point would be kind of become fuzzy. It wouldn't be as precise if you would put temperature. I think that the temperature argument means like a little temperature won't change the scaling, but I think it'll soften a little bit the return point.
But you won't be able to suddenly remember the internal ones.
I think you'll remember it probably on large scales. On the small scales, you'll forget a little bit the details.
I mean, once you've gone to this point with temperature, would you ever be able to see this point?
It depends how big the temperature is.
Yeah, you might. You might be kind of, you might be spiraling around it, but with a sort of very, very small. You see, I think we have to be careful with the temperature because, whenever you go along this field, along this A thing, you know, you are, even if you think random fieldizing model, you're kind of destabilizing some of these spins, right? So it is kind of you're tilting it, and then you're tilting it back again, and then you're tilting it more.
Locally kicking it.
Yeah, so you know, at these tipping points, you know, the temperature might assist, you know, when this thing is at zero field, you have these barriers, but then you apply the field, you're tilting it. So, you know, some of these spins might get more susceptible to be terminally activated. So that, you know, it is, you know, because you're kind of changing, you know, the tilt is changing the landscape, which, you know, in this case, you just let those slide that became unstable because of the tilt, but there will be a whole bunch of guys that are close to this sort of, to this instability, and the terminally, they could be terminally assisted.
Okay, so, but look, I mean, I'm not making any statement about what noise does, but I think that's a question that, I mean, can be addressed and to be actually asked, I mean, does it do something of this kind?
I think this is a homework. Maybe we should sort of, you know, the random field 1D Ising people should basically, you know, because our claim, you know, the random field Ising model people would claim that, you know, these double clinks, you know, would, if at all, would not be on the cycle, but on the transient that leads to the cycle. So probably the smoking gun is to sort of just take a 1D random field Ising model, you know, start with some weird state outside of the cycle, do exactly your swirling protocol, you know, big field, small field, until you drive it into, you know, I don't know, this thing, and see whether we see these multiple kinks on the way of the transient, whether we see, you know, without noise, whether we see that, you know, it's, there's a, again an evaporation effect that maybe, you know, where that takes sort of, it's a slow process, and so on and so forth. I think, you know, that is probably the first thing to do, and this can be done relatively easy because it's just such a simple model.
Okay, so
homework.
So you were saying one dimensional. Do you think one dimension is enough for getting a group like that?
Yeah, you get this already in one dimension.
So what's the claim? You said something about the random fieldizing model.
Because it's so simple, you know.
The claim is what?
So the claim is, you know, so the claim is that in some sense, you know, this hysteresis picture out there, in the SID 1D swelling model, basically corresponds to, you know, we've trained this thing to the infinity, it is at the absorbing state, okay? And, you know, the other stuff basically in the swelling model, the double membranes, triple membranes, basically occur on the way to the absorbing state, but the thing is that the way to the absorbing state is very, very long, so you'd see these things for a very long time. You know, this thing, all this random field easing model, even in 1D, also has a path to the absorbing cycle there. So the question is, do we on this path to the absorbing cycle, if we drive it with double, you know, with two fields or whatever, do we also see on that path, you know, something that has the double, you know, that has this double kink structure?
Okay, okay, so homework has been assigned.
Sorry, I didn't mean to sort of, but I think this is sort of just to do it is doable, and you know, if no one does it, then I'll do it. But
but the professor should always do the homework problems. I mean, it's
okay. I'm not a professor anymore, but that's okay. But no,
In just the last little bit, I want to raise one other question which bothers me. So unless we. I mean, maybe we should continue talking about this, but this other question does bother me. Is that one of the things that I kind of hold dear in this thing that we're doing, and maybe this is totally cockeyed, but it's what I'm, you know, it's what I'm hoping for, that something like this could emerge, is that, you know, we can classify a little bit something about something about these different memories and what are in one category versus what in another category. And the picture that I like very much came from the charge density wave stuff that Sue and Peter did, which was this idea of the marginal state. That is, you keep pushing, 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 you keep now it didn't work anymore, and so that's where you end up because there's nothing going to keep you going, right? I think that's, am I saying it, that's probably, you can say it more sophisticatedly than I can, but.
In terms of losing your keys.
Okay, so she lost her keys, but I, Yeah. But anyway, that's the big, and that's what's happening here. I mean, this pushes these things out until they don't interact anymore, and you're done. So that's this one kind of thing. And you know, I would say in some way, a lot of these things that we've been talking about have that taste to them. You keep pushing until that's the last thing that you've got, and then something, you've kind of cleared the space for you. And one way of, but then the other kind of memory that I want to think of is, oh, well, you're in some particular well in this energy landscape. And that's somehow a different beast. I mean, so the associative memories of the Hopfield memory, I think you're saying, you know, it's not based on this. It was, you have some rule, Hebbian rule, I guess is what they're called, but, you know, of how you train this thing, and then some well begins to exist in this space, and this is, you get close and you flow downhill into this memory, and that seems to me, gee, that's a different kind of beast than this moving to the end of this flat landscape till you suddenly see something going on. Mm-hmm. So, and but then I think about that and I say, okay, those are the two extremes. But then I see everything with you know, your plasticity, and gee, plasticity isn't that just moving on a flat landscape. I mean, there's energy barriers in the way, and you know, you're doing something, but you've cleared out energy barriers up to something. I don't know what you've cleared it out to, but and then you go over to the kind of stuff that Sri worked on with the you know, a jam system, and you shear it back and forth cyclically, and gee, it looks a lot like this. I mean, not exactly like this. It doesn't really, isn't flat here, but you can remember one memory in it, and you fall into this repeatable state. And boy, that's got an energy minimum in it. I mean, that's you're really going between one well and another well and another well, coming around to where you get back to. So, gee, that seems to me different. But so it seems to me I've just painted myself into a corner. In one case, I had this marginal idea. In the other case, I had this energy well idea, and now I found this case which looks like this marginal case, but it has energy wells in it. And how do are these two things connected? Are they part of the same thing, or are they different? I mean, another way of saying it, perhaps, is what I claim these guys do, and all the ones we've been talking about, is I'm remembering a path. I'm remembering the path of this thing, how it went from one to another. In and so in that sense, in my if Sue's allowed to talk about losing keys, the picture that I have for this is it's muscle memory. That is, you know, if I want to make a octave jump on a piano, I don't just sit here and wait for the Hebbian rule to come in to make sure my shoulder knows where that is, and then I go over here and I wait for a while to know where that is. I remember the path. I keep doing it over and over and over and over again until that's the thing that gets memorized. It's the path that gets memorized, and it's how many times I did the path, not how long I sat in A or in B, but it was the path in between A and B that matters. And so, those are some of the issues that I'm kind of confused about.
So I wanted to mention a couple of things, but maybe given the time, we can sort of think of taking this up in the next discussion. But So, I mean, I won't mention sort of what happens in the glass, but something that we've been looking at recently is looking at something like this colloidal model, but in a different regime, right? So this is now looking at soft spheres, which basically if they come into contact, repel each other, just enough to get out of each other's way. And so in these, so you can, you know, think of this as sort of hard disks or hard spheres. It'll give you the same behavior. The soft part is not important. And so in some sense, I mean, you should imagine this to be a perfectly good model for everything you've been saying. But in these systems at sort of somewhat larger amplitudes maybe than what you've been talking about, there is a new regime where the stationary state that the system goes into is it's called loop reversible, in the sense that during one cycle, particles don't reach a state where they don't see each other. They do have collisions, but the collisions sort of result in the system, all the particles coming back to their original positions at the end of a cycle. Okay, and so this is now, you know, if you want to sort of talk in terms of the landscapes versus, you know, flat or complicated landscapes, this system also has a flat landscape. So like these are billiard boards that are colliding in a shear cycle, and they show behavior that's actually very similar to glasses. And so it seems like, so and so these collisions that are happening during the cycle, when the system is still stroboscopically stationary, are playing the role of noise that, you know, in these cases that you've been talking about. So there's some sort of so I think that's sort of an intermediate case between thinking about sort of a landscape picture and this kind of a flat landscape picture, where what you end up with is only a memory of the boundaries. So yesterday we were sort of trying to make these space-time plots, right? So basically, in these cases that you've been talking about, once the system has reached a steady state, it's sort of the world line is a constant world line, right? You just sit in one place, right? If you remove the sort of affine part of your deformation. Whereas when you have collisions, that's not true. You do actually sort of bump into the boundaries that is allowed. And that makes a difference, that the behavior changes. What it doesn't change is the idea that there is some boundary to the sort of region that you explore, whose memory is stored. That doesn't change. But the substructure can be different. And maybe we can sort of talk about that next time.
Okay. Good. So we...